This episode of How to Save the World is sponsored by Ateek, a New Zealand zero-waste beauty company on a mission to rid the world of plastic waste.
Check them out at ateek.co.nz. That's Ateek, E-T-H-I-Q-U-E. Hello and welcome to How to Save the World. We've got another good news episode because it went so well the first time. It gave us warm fuzzies inside and we love doing it. So we thought we'd do another one of these. G'day, Wave.
G'day, Tim.
How are you?
I'm very good. This does actually make me happy. I'm surprised. It's very palpable.
Yeah, it's good going into something when you know you're going to talk about good news.
Mm.
You get a stride in one step. How many bits of good news do you have?
I've got a few up my sleeve, but I reckon two.
Yeah, I've got two as well, but both of mine are kind of, they're good news, but tempered good news.
Oh.
So it's like, good news, but...
Tim.
But it's good to have slightly, you know, complicated things to talk about, because then we can chew them over slightly. So do you want to kick off and maybe give us like a beautiful,
okay. Simplified, okay.
Pure good news?
Yes, this is pure good news. I'm so excited. You can probably guess what it's going to be, because I've already gone like mental about it on social media a few weeks ago.
I try to keep myself off as much as I can, semi-unsuccessfully. What is it?
It's the government announcing the container return scheme.
Woo! Hey, this is great because I didn't get my head around the specifics of this. So
oh, cool.
Please run me through. What has happened? What is the journey to get us here?
Well, I'm so excited because it's been a long time coming. And me and, well, not really me, but just the crew of people that... have been campaigning for this. It's been a long road and it's just so exciting to have it over the line. What it is the government's announced that they're basically giving money to Marlborough District Council and Auckland Council to create a scheme, to sort of design a scheme, and they've got to get that done by next year. So the pace is on, so that's good. And they will be designing something so that when we get go and have a drink, when that bottle is returned to a depot, we get the 10 cents back. And that 10 cents, by the way, they haven't set that price yet. It would be 10 minimum,
right.
I think. Could be 20, whatever.
So per glass bottle, did you say?
No, just that's part of designing the scheme. So we're working out what those parameters are. Very similar to how with the plastic bags, it's like you think, oh yeah, easy, ban plastic bags.
Yeah.
But then you start going, well, hang on, how thick?
What is a plastic
bag? Yeah, exactly.
Bag?
Yeah. So that's part of what they'll all be working out. But yeah, it'll be plastic, glass,
and is this a nationwide
aluminium. Yes, it has
scheme?
To be nationwide. Otherwise, you get these bizarre kind of black market trade things going on up
yeah,
and down the
right.
country. Yeah.
Amazing. So I've got a weird feeling that we used to have this with cans, but was it a private... Because I'll tell you what I remember. When I was a kid, my older brother used to collect hundreds of cans and bring them, when we lived in Christchurch, to like a recycling depot or something and get a few bucks.
There have been all sorts of schemes, little schemes here and there. Sometimes it's the producers themselves, like Swapper Crate, that want to get their bottles back and that
yep.
kind of stuff.
Because they've got a value to
the
material.
Yeah, it makes sense for them. But the other thing is that aluminium does have a decent price to it. So it's possibly actually just the price your brother was getting for the scrap as well back in the day.
Can I ask you a question you probably may not know the answer to? There's like an urban legend that the tab on the cans is pure aluminium.
Oh, I've heard that.
Do you know if that's true or not?
I don't know.
Maybe I should look that up.
How do you know that the can itself isn't like just pure aluminium?
Isn't it an alloy to bring prices down, I assume? So I've just looked it up and the answer is, unfortunately, nothing could be further from the truth. Soda can tabs have absolutely no special monetary value. They can be sold for the recycling value of the aluminium they contain, just like the soda can or anything else. Well, there you go.
Well, look, onwards and upwards with the good news.
Yeah.
This container return scheme, what is particularly exciting about it is that we've got a recycling system currently that just hasn't really been working. We've been spending as ratepayers over $20 million a year just to try and get our recycling processed. And we think we're kind of doing a good job, but actually, like, if you're at a picnic or you're out somewhere and you've got bottles from your picnic or whatever, what do you do with them? Most people don't. take them home and exactly just chuck them in the bin. So we've had about, there was a report that said that there were equivalent of 700 full Boeing 747s going into the landfill every year. Of landfill and litter, actually, so like into the
700 passenger jets.
Yeah, the big ones.
Oof.
Yeah.
Wait, is that of all trash? Or
no,
of...
that's the recycling that we could have been recycling every year.
Oh, what?
If we
holy smoke.
If
how
we
big
had
are
the
our
container,
tips?
Well, some of it doesn't even make it to the landfill. Some of it's just a lot of it's ending up in the marine environment. So that's probably the reason why I'm most excited about this coming in. But the other thing that's super exciting is that it's been really hard for recyclers to actually kind of make ends meet. Like a classic, we just had that recycling is recycling legit episode.
Yes.
And we talked about how to get glass bottles from Wanaka up to OI here in Auckland just is impossible in terms of it making sense in a monetary way. But now they will be able to do that because of the 10 cents and the processing fee that they get. So it actually means that, so we've got councils all over New Zealand that have chosen to commingle, which is putting your glass and everything all in one bin, like Auckland Council does that. And that is for economic reasons. And it's terrible for the recyclers. It just brings down the overall product. And OI, the glass recyclers, actually can't use a lot of the glass that's come through that process. And so we've just had a lot of downcycling, and this container return scheme is going to totally change that. It's going to inject millions into the right places so that people can do the right things, and it's always going to be economically viable to recycle your bottles, and we're all going to have the incentive to do it.
That is so cool. Where does the money come from? Is this like, does government put the money up?
Oh, no,
get this done?
No, that's what's cool about it. At the moment, the government's putting the money up to basically have a recycling scheme across New Zealand. It's going to shift to consumer and producer. So when you buy your bottle or whatever, you will be paying an extra 10 cents at that point, which you won't know. It will just be
baked into the price.
Exactly. It's in the price, and the manufacturers might choose to absorb a little bit of that price or whatever, but it is across the board. So it probably won't be that notable for people.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you have finished and you're wanting to return that bottle, you actually just get that money back.
Oh, so it's like a rebate.
It's a total zero sum for the consumer.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And the other cool thing is that there's always a lag. This is actually the genius. This is how the scheme works. There's a lag between you paying that extra 10 cents and you redeeming it. And so en masse, that's millions of dollars that's in the bank earning interest. And that's the main way that the scheme's funded, through that interest.
Huh.
And then there's the bottles that never get redeemed and you've still paid the 10 cents on them. So
yeah,
it really adds up.
That's very cool. And it makes me think as well that, just based on my experience of, remembering my brother collecting cans and stuff, it'll get a whole bunch of kids into this, because now there's sort of a pocket money incentive to get them into recycling and waste collection and that
yes,
sort of thing.
Yes, it's
so
huge.
There's all these
it's great.
Cool little fingers that come off of it, positive little unexpected things.
Exactly. It's a real nice positive feedback loop. We should have over 2,000 new jobs. That's quite conservative. We'll easily get lots of new jobs out of it. And really awesome for, like you say, the kids, but also community groups. Like, such easy fundraisers. Like, a lot of people, sure, you might want to get your, I don't know, what would it be, a couple of bucks every week or something from your own meager drinking habit.
Yeah.
But a lot of people are just really happy to just give those bottles straight to a charity.
Yeah.
So they can do their own charity drives.
Schools probably become a bit of a magnet for these.
Yeah,
for
and
these
that's also part of what's cool about these guys designing the scheme right now too, is making sure that community groups can actually access that stream, rather than like if it was only, say, through, you could only return it through a vending machine and that was owned by maybe the producers that made the bottles in the first place. So that is an option, but it would cut out all of the fundraising opportunities for people.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Oh, this is really exciting. So, and this has been a long journey to get here, right? Like,
yes.
you and the whānau have been fighting for a long time to get to this point.
I'm the standing on the shoulders of giants person who's just come along in the last 5 years or so, but there have been people campaigning about this for oh, at least a decade longer, really.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, there's this one guy particularly, Warren Snow, who has actually dedicated his life to this. He's, would he be? Definitely in his 60s. I don't know if he's past that. But anyway, he has just been just so passionate about getting this across. Like, so he's been part of Envision, who he founded Envision, which do, among other things, study tours. And so they've actually, like, the reason this has happened now is because people have finally seen the magic. And a lot of that has been these study tours over the years that Envision's run, which is getting, like, key councillors or members of government or whatever to actually go over to South Australia and see with their own eyes what's happening over there and how it's affected the community and the recycling industry. And the and so not just the people processing stuff, but actually the people who are like Carter Holt Harvey or whoever, who actually are getting or wanting to buy the product in the end, because it means that it's a much better product for everyone.
Has that made quite a big impact in South Australia, where these programs have been run for a little while?
Yeah,
now?
So typically, well, like, our recycling rate is maybe as low as 45%, maybe as high as about 58%. We don't know, because the industry don't actually give us the figures. So everyone's just sort of trying to guess what they might be. But those recycling rates, you could really expect those to get up to at least 80%, like, at least, just almost overnight.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
without
so cool.
The government having to put millions, which they are, which they have been, like, in addition to sort of councils running and funding recycling, there's all these other grants that have been given out to a lot of it to industry, actually, to help them try and sort of work this out, when actually the solution was there all along.
Yeah,
yeah.
It does kind of make you wonder why we didn't do it slightly
oh,
earlier.
Yeah.
But we're here now.
Yeah, we're here
now.
That
is tremendously good
news.
Yeah,
so it's awesome.
That's so cool.
Mm, mm.
Hooray!
Hooray! and once more with passion. That didn't sound very...
Sorry, it's because it's so early. I'm still getting through my first coffee.
That coffee.
That's as excited as I could possibly sound in this moment.
Hooray!
Hooray!
That's a bit better.
Right, my one is a bit more, it's not quite as, purely positive, but it is quite, oh, like...
You're so intrigued. What is it
I'll
that you've got?
I'll explain why I'm so
such
excited.
Such amazing good news with this
the background,
sting in the tail.
The background is horrific, but then the sort of the upshot is kind of positive. So, it's about Chernobyl.
Oh, gosh.
Which is the single greatest nuclear disaster that has ever happened on the planet ever. Happened in 1986, a reactor melted down due to a poor design of the nuclear energy facility there. Lots of people died. I think there's only been admitted less than 50 official deaths, according to the Soviet government, because they tried to cover everything up.
Get out of town.
Anyone who kind of knows anything about it reckons that there's probably quite easily thousands and thousands of attributable deaths to the meltdown. And just to give an indication of why that's the case, there was more than 400 times more radiation emitted at Chernobyl in the meltdown than there was released at Hiroshima in the atomic bomb.
What?
Which was like,
say that again.
So a weapon by design, the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima, 400 times more radiation was released at Chernobyl.
Whoa.
Yeah. And this only
it's
happened.
It's a good fact, Tim.
Yeah, it's
but
a scary fact.
But you've got to quickly
fact.
Move on to the
I know,
good news.
I know.
It's our good news episode.
So this happened 33 years ago, and there's actually only been two nuclear disasters of like at this level that have ever happened, and Chernobyl was the first. Fukushima was the other, which only happened less than 10 years ago. I think it was 2011,
quite recently, wasn't it? Yeah,
Japan. And so as a result, it was incredibly unpredictable what was going to happen, and people just simply didn't know what to expect with this level of radiation. So one of the things that happened is the international community, when the news actually did get out, and if you haven't watched the HBO series Chernobyl, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It is genuinely like...
I'll check it out.
It is the best TV show I've ever seen. It's
what?
So,
really?
Yeah, and I'm not even that into dramas, but it's just so well
of
made.
Of all the TV shows?
Yeah. It's so good.
Okay.
It's really good. Now, I'm not the only one to say that. It's like really highly rated.
Wow.
It's incredible.
Okay.
Anyway, so after all of the kind of cover up, you know, started to melt away and the reality of the situation started to get known by the international community. The international community really stepped in because it was also they had to have some immediate things that happened. They started pouring like concrete as fast as they can on top of the reactor to try and stop further precipitation of all of this radiation getting out. And then as time went on, they had to kind of keep rebuilding the structures, and they built like a lead, I think it's a lead lined sarcophagus for the actual, like, where the meltdown happened itself. And as the Soviet Union broke down, which was not that long after Chernobyl itself, the international community had to step in and basically take charge of this huge disaster and keep rebuilding the structures that are around it to contain the radiation. But one of the big important things that happened in the immediate wake of it is they said there's no humans can be within a 30-kilometer radius of Chernobyl. Like, you'll die. There's just too much radiation for humans to exist here, and it's probably going to be the case for up to 20,000 years. So they just said no people. So there is a Chernobyl exclusion zone where there's a few people who I think get rotated in and out and obviously have a lot of safety precautions who work there, but it's like less than 200, I think, who just kind of keep looking after certain things. But by just accident, it's become this de facto wildlife reserve as a result. So once again, because this is the first time that this has happened on this scale ever, no one knew what to expect. And actually, the predictions at the time were super dire that all life there would just cease to exist and it would become a bit of a desert. And quite the opposite has happened. It's actually become this thriving home to wildlife, and in particular big mammals.
What, really?
Yeah, so there's
and are these big mammals with five legs and three eyes, or?
Interesting you should say that. So there's a bunch of different scientists and scientific groups who have started throwing in, especially recently, to try and track what's going on there with the animal populations. And according to scientist Michael Byrne, who's the lead author on one of these, I think he's part of an international group of scientists, he's the lead. He said, "No wolves there were glowing, all have four legs, two eyes and one tail." And that's a quote from him. So, and they've observed like incredible things. So they've started putting motion sensitive cameras in there so they can start to track what kind of species are there. They've seen huge populations of wolves, raccoon dogs, red foxes, boars, badgers, bison, brown bears, lynxes. And I think they introduced this weird species of horse there that kind of look like miniature horses, and they're thriving as well because they roam around in packs.
Cool.
So there's more than 200 species of birds there. It's not like all good news, obviously, because there is, you know, such an incredible amount of radiation that people can't be there for thousands of years. So there's definitely been some...
Are we more sensitive to it? Or
well,
is
that, it? That has been one floated possibility by the scientists while they're trying to figure out how this is happening. But the more consensus opinion, and this is totally what I would agree with...
Yeah.
As scientists are now just saying, it's simply the lack of human intervention there. That's all it is.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as you were saying all of this. I was going, oh man, you know, it turns out that just humans and what we do is actually worse for the environment than a major nuclear meltdown.
That's exactly.
Like, if we just got out of the picture.
That's exactly,
but we all know
what
that, don't
scientists
we?
Are saying. Yeah. But so that's why I say it's like, it's good news, bad news, good news,
yeah,
sort of thing.
Yeah, it is. It's not
like universally good news. It's not like the animals are unaffected, because particularly smaller invertebrates like insects have their numbers have gone right down, and they observed that around Fukushima as well. All the bug life seems to be super affected and that all goes right down, which is bad because obviously that's got a lot of flow on effects for the rest of the ecology
Actually, it'd be interesting longer term, because you would think that the insects would be quite a foundational part of the thing, but
they're adapting as well. There's species in there. So for example, they've observed that frogs in the exclusion zone have noticeably darker skin than frogs outside the exclusion zone, and they reckon that might be an adaptive trait, that they absorb less radiation as a result.
The other sort of slightly complicated thing about your good news, Tim, is that you know, I don't think any of our listeners would be thinking it, but what if you could take from this that, oh, well, nuclear fallout's not as bad as we thought. We could all just...
So
that's
it
an option.
Is.
Show me that big red button.
So, okay, let me speak to that. First of all, I have obviously glossed over all of the incredible human suffering that happened for this, like, that precipitated this event. But the reason why this, I think, can be filed under good news is the way that I'm looking at it is it shows the resilience of nature and that... This is providing a bit of a blueprint for humans, and it relates to actually the last Good News episode that I was talking about.
I was thinking
acid
that
rain.
With acid rain, yeah.
So the scientists found that they were dumping acid into a lake to try and make it more acidic so they could conduct an experiment to observe how acid rain gets formed, and they were putting so much acid in and they couldn't figure out why the body of water wasn't becoming more acidic at large, and it was because they didn't know that this bacteria was counteracting the acid they were putting in by basically eating it and neutralizing it. So similar to that, it's like we've got a bit of a blueprint here of if we can just create some big zones like nature wildlife reserves and just get the hell out of nature's way, nature can come back and bounce back way stronger than we ever predicted was possible.
And there's even arguments for, like, where you say just get right out of there, because even putting paths in, they become corridors for weeds and all sorts of things. So our impact is always a little bit more complicated than we think.
Yeah.
But I on reflection, Tim, I reckon I'll give you a 10 out of 10 for that.
Oh, it's a 10 out of 10.
And I'll tell
Huge.
You why. Because we're only going to get out of this mess if we've got hope, because actually we can get out of it, but it's reliant on all of us deciding that we're going to make these small changes. And that is one of the biggest things to give us hope, is that because we can all see how fucked up it is in terms of some of these statistics, and when you see those statistics, those are the things that you can freak out about, and you end up in that sort of negative loop of going, oh well, it's too late, it's too catastrophic. But to see these things that kind of look like anomalies and go, wow, you know, nature is so resilient.
So resilient.
And it's just a knife edge. That's all it is, isn't it? We don't want to end up feeling like, oh, we can do whatever we like because nature's so resilient, when clearly we have the upper hand.
But, it's resilient when we're not there. Yeah. That's the big takeaway that I'm getting from the Chernobyl thing. And the reason why, like, I mean, this obviously was such a cataclysmic disaster for so, so many people who were there, and so many people living under the Soviet government. So it was just like
bad upon
bad.
I knew a lady, actually, who came out of Chernobyl.
Really?
Yeah, an elderly Russian lady.
Does she live here in New
Zealand? Yeah, she came to New Zealand in the 80s with her husband. Her daughter-in-law died. She was a teacher at the time, and so she did that classic rescue all the children, running around trying to save them, and so she had huge amounts of radiation at the time, and she died of cancer a few years later, and then her husband died in New Zealand but also of cancer and quite possibly related.
And that's the thing, I think that's happened to tens of thousands of people, but they just haven't tracked that because the government hasn't, you know, wanted to keep that statistic. But the thing with Chernobyl is that for humans to get out of a zone where we, like, could be, like, an attractive living space, it takes something like this to happen. But by virtue of it happening and us being able to observe the effects, we wouldn't really have had this opportunity to observe, like, a huge area like this come back to life after these crazy effects if Chernobyl hadn't happened. So it's not like it was worth it or anything, but there's, you know, in the face of these awful events which we humans create, there can be some scientific breakthroughs that can be discovered off the back of it, but B, sometimes some really positive news, like going and looking and going, hey, these animals are actually thriving in this environment now.
Yeah.
I don't know if I mentioned this, but they reckon there's 7 times the amount of grey wolves in the exclusion zone than in the surrounding areas. And they are pointing to simply the fact that there's no humans there is the reason why.
It's cool.
It is cool.
Because wolves are cool.
Wolves are so cool, man. Wolves and bears. Does it get cooler than them? I don't think so.
I'm not going to argue with you, Tom. It's a hard one to refute.
This episode is brought to you by Etique. Etique is a New Zealand natural beauty company that stopped over 3.3 million plastic bottles going to landfill. That is a lot, eh?
That's a lot. Their gorgeous hair, face and body wash products are mindfully packaged in biodegradable and compostable materials because Etique are dedicated to building a better world.
Atik's products are all certified animal cruelty-free, made of only plant-based and vegan ingredients, and they're kind to your wallet because they last 2 to 5 times longer than bottled beauty products.
Get yourself or someone you care about some Atik today by going to atikworld.com.
And that's Atik, E-T-H-I-Q-U-E. It's French, I think.
Well, my next good news thing, I asked a few people. I was thinking it'd be good to put the word out there, and it was so interesting what I got back. All mates of mine who are all into environmental stuff, mostly, who have dedicated their lives to whether it's community groups or whatever they're doing, social enterprises, huge range of things. And I was trying to get people to be really specific. And just what was coming back was this overwhelming sense of excitement that things are changing really fast, and meaning that all the stuff that everyone was going, oh, so what do you do? Oh, that's a bit weird. Oh, what a, you know, good for you. That's nice. Pat you on the head. And now people are getting it, and it's just happening so fast. So there's this sense of excitement that actually I realise, and that's what's so important about us doing these good news episodes, is that when you're new into, when you've just heard all of the bad news, and so that has been your motivation to go, right, I want to do something, but you're not actually in the world, you're not immersed in a world of people that are living and breathing this stuff, I think that's actually when you're going to be most likely at your most negative, because you haven't, you've only seen the downside, and you haven't realised the extent to which these are, like, thousands of incredible initiatives just perhaps right even in your local area. Totally. Because you haven't had the opportunity to connect with them. So yeah, it's really cool seeing people that are working in the field just saying, like, I used to run workshops and 5 people would turn up, now they're sold out, and people are just getting so excited about all these various things. Like I mean, there's so much happening with green spaces or local food. There was a woman, Tara Moala, who runs projects out of Pub Zero in Monaco, and she said that she had 5 people turn up to workshops a couple of years ago, and now, yeah, they're sellouts, and it's all to do with people wanting to work out how they can make the most of waste in their run a social enterprise out of stuff in the waste stream.
So weirdly, I had this exact conversation yesterday with a friend of mine who works for the environment, or used to work for the Environment Defence Fund. Is that what it's called?
You're the one who knows, actually. I haven't heard of the Environment Defence Fund.
I wouldn't want to talk too much about them without doing the research and stuff, but they're this awesome sort of lobby group, I guess, that lobbies the government on behalf of, well, the environment, really. But she was saying that she organises these huge conferences, these annual conferences, that all of these incredible people, scientists, activists, social entrepreneurs who are in the green space, and politicians go to. She actually got me a ticket a couple of years ago that I got to go to, and it was where Jacinda was running. So she had just announced that she was going to be the leader of Labour, and it was in the lead up to the election. But anyway, so my friend was who's one of the organisers of this annual meeting, she said that the sea change she has seen in the 5 years she's been involved with that is unreal.
It is.
Completely unreal. The rate of change.
Human society shouldn't change that fast. It's unprecedented. Like, we have culture that, and society that are like, it's not a fluid thing. We're these pack animals, and we're all looking at each other, and we're not going to do a thing unless somebody else does a thing.
And then a few weirdos jump out. A couple follow them, and then we'll go, oh, okay, we're going this way now, cool.
Yeah, but like the rate at which, like, there's just this huge inertia around the values that we were brought up with, and our traditions, and the infrastructure that we've got. That's a really massive one. Like, we're all wanting to shop in different ways, but we've got this old existing infrastructure, and yet it's just happening so fast. It's
what she said as well, which was so heartening, is because she deals with a lot of business leaders and, like, people in very big companies, and she said, you know, in New Zealand, dealing with all the people that she deals with, because we were talking about climate deniers, and she said, there's actually, like, there's no one that I've dealt with who I think doesn't want to do the right thing. It's just the balance of, like, figuring out how to get that into their business. But everyone is genuinely really keen.
Yeah.
And it seems, I don't know, it's almost like you can kind of put your media conspiracy head on a little bit, but I think the people who aren't on board with this, I suspect, might be getting quite an undue amount of airtime, because I think both in terms of their number and their sway over things, they're in the huge minority, the
yeah,
people
they are.
Who aren't on board with this thing.
That's right. But then I don't think they are getting much airtime now, are they?
I hope not. You see them pop up here and there.
Here and there.
Or it's just kind of, it's just that thing of making it a bit wishy-washy, that like it's, you know, the science isn't settled or that kind of thing. It's...
Oh, yeah. Anyway, good news. Good news.
Really
Let's
good
not
news.
Dwell on that.
No.
The other thing that's related to this was I mentioned about the I guess you call it shopping infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking back to, again, just the rate of change. And when we did our zero waste year in 2008, looking back on what we had available to us back then and what we've got available to us now, it's just phenomenal. Things are just popping up everywhere, whether it's like these refilleries or organic stores or farmers markets, apps. There's just so much.
Let me ask you a question on behalf of the listener, actually, Wave, because if there's someone who's been maybe listening to a few episodes of our podcast and getting more interested in this sort of thing, and maybe they've changed a couple behaviours, but they're actually wanting to get involved with a local group of some sort, how do you reckon people should kick off with that? What sort of...
When you say a local group of some sort...
Well, there's many different initiatives that you could get involved with in different ways. I kind of want to have a big umbrella for this. So it could be...
Yeah.
Yeah, you go.
Well, no, I'm just seeking clarification. Like, are you meaning around it shopping
It could be around composting or community gardens. It could be around
okay, so
like
literally
a recycling
anything.
Collective.
Just how do I
yeah.
find out what's going on?
Yeah,
and
like how do you find the people in your area who are doing the stuff?
Well, see, for
is
me,
it as simple
it was,
as Googling around.
I think it might be actually, but that's a theory I haven't tested because. For me, the way I connected with people was a bit weird. It was through not dodgy.
Was at these swingers parties.
Yeah, yeah.
Some
so
of the
it was this night because we did this public thing and we put ourselves out there and said, "Oh, we've got no idea what we're doing."
And for those who haven't heard the first episode, that was Waveney's journey into zero waste ten years ago.
Bumbling idiot. Yeah. So we had these people actually come to us because we'd put ourselves out there and they could find us and. They connected with us, which was an incredible thing to feel these people coming around to support us. So for us, it was all through relationships. But I've got a theory about...
Well, that's my method. Be a big, loud, public idiot about it.
Put
just
a
be
sign
like,
up in your
I
front
I want to do good, but I don't know how.
Well, that would work. I would so knock on someone's door if they had a sign in their yard. But actually, this is what I reckon. I reckon that if you've thought of it, then that's actually, you're already have won if you've thought of it. Because every time I think of some crazy idea and then go, oh, someone should invent that, and I Google it, they already have. But it's like, I'm never going to come across it unless I actually think of it. Like, it would be a great example. I've been typing too much and just going, oh, damn it, you know, here I am sitting here, everything sort of sucks physically while my mind's so engaged with the stuff. I was like, wouldn't it be amazing if there are all of these different textures or on your keyboard? So like every time you touch one of the buttons, you're experiencing a totally different texture.
Huh.
Like sandpaper or fur or
yeah,
whatever.
Right.
So and then I Googled it and sure enough,
it's a thing.
Someone's done it. And what was the other one? There was another really weird one I thought of. And it's like, again, it's been done. And you're like, oh, you just have to think of it.
Keep cracking on, Wave. I believe in you.
So,
one of these inventions is going to make you rich.
Yeah, one day. But so that's my point. You're asking, how do you connect? But I think if you were to be just putting in your neighborhood into a Google search and then some keywords and see what happens.
And maybe if you're in a smaller place as well, I think there's a perpetual... it's not like a fear, but it's like an arresting human characteristic that if you're not doing something perfectly, you just won't bother. That kind of arresting perfectionism. But if you're in a smaller town and there isn't a bunch of stuff, maybe just have an ask around and see if anyone else is interested and start a small little project.
Okay,
yourself.
I'll give you some sort of heads up on some basic things.
Yeah,
so
there
is transition towns. You could Google that and see if there's one in your neighborhood.
What's the elevator pitch for a transition town?
Transitioning away from a town that's dependent on fossil fuels. And we're working out now how we can make a nice, easy transition into a future where we're going to be less reliant on them. So people who are thinking about your local food infrastructure or movement, ways to move around your neighbourhood, things like that. So it's a group of people that are already thinking about this stuff. Another one is just actually Googling environment centres.
Uh-huh.
Most areas would have, even if it's not near you, there would be an environment centre that would cover your region. That would be your one-stop shop for finding out about what's available in your area.
It's like a hub for all of these sorts of programs and...
Yeah, so Environment Centre could be, they typically would run courses, or they might, like there's one in Kaipātiki in Auckland that has started out planting trees and was a restoration group and has grown into so much more than that. And they will know, they're just very well networked. They might often have a few council contracts to deliver some education programs or whatever. And lots of different community groups could be using them as a hub as well.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, I've got one more thing.
Great.
Should I get into it?
Yeah.
It's actually like on a similar track of the acid rain one I did last time.
Yeah,
I don't know if
it.
That's cheating or not, but it was on the smog in Los Angeles.
Ooh.
Because there's a lot of old movies that I remember seeing where LA was just absolutely blanketed in smog.
Like, Christchurch was real similar too.
Yeah,
it's had a real turnaround really with the smog.
Yeah,
I remember biking along and I'd have my hands up in the air because I could just touch the top of it when I was biking.
The smog.
Yeah.
I think it might be, well, so there's a lot of contributing factors, but similar reason in that Christchurch is so flat and it's got hills on one side and water on another. Mm. So it becomes a, what do they, it's like a pollution trap.
Mm.
So LA has gone through a very dramatic history of smog. It first rolled in the 1940s and it was so severe and so thick and blanketed the city so densely and caused so many issues that they thought it was a chemical attack by the Japanese because it happened during World War II. So there are these historic photos of Angelenos, I believe they're called, wearing gas masks, rocking around. And there's like people in soft top cars wearing full on like World War II chemical masks. And there's even one of a donkey that they had to fix goggles to at the zoo because its eyes were getting so irritated. So people were getting hospitalized. Car crashes were happening because of the low visibility. Like it was an absolute nightmare. And no one actually knew what was happening because it happened so quickly. So
long, a word of warning.
Long story short, it was cars, but it took them ages to figure it out because they looked at the back of car exhausts and they went, that's not brown, it's clear. The thing that's coming out, that's
it.
Honestly,
we've come a long way.
Yeah,
that's good.
I know.
News in itself.
So they looked at it and they couldn't put it together, and the missing ingredient was the fact that sunlight breaks down the stuff that's coming out of the makeup that's coming out of car exhausts and turns that into ozone, which is just another word for smog. So it took them a surprisingly long amount of... Yeah, I know. I see you looking weird about that. I read that in several articles, that ozone and smog are the same thing. I don't know.
So you want your O3 up in the...
I'm going to put my sources at the... In the
I hope
show
you're
links.
Right about that.
We'll call smog smog.
To
I'll remove that.
With.
We'll call smog smog.
Yeah, let's do that.
As I say, it took a surprisingly long amount of time for them to figure it out. And it was basically down to this one Dutch chemical scientist who was a real big racing car enthusiast.
And he, for him.
Yeah. I think it was,
or her.
It was a guy. He was at Caltech. He was a professor. And in 1952, his name's Ari Hagen Schmidt. He distilled the air into acids, figured out it was cars. And he was like, oh man, everyone's going to fucking hate me. And they did. He came out with his findings and he got ridiculed and vilified. And his career was briefly destroyed before sort of coming back later when they were like, oh, okay, turns out he was right.
I've got a mild version of that today because I'm a natural people pleaser and it's such a bummer having this message all the time.
Oh, wife. Did something happen today on your way here, or you just mean you were feeling that?
No, I mean generally in life, like I feel like my calling is to communicate that we're all up shit creek people and we need to do something about it. But actually it's kind of against my nature.
Well, we've all got our cross to bear, and the combination of those two things probably makes you the perfectly placed person to communicate this message.
Hope so.
So think about it that way. They eventually, California formed an Air Resources Board in 1967, so it took that long for them to kind of churn through the legislative stuff.
1967.
Yeah, so this guy discovered what was going on in 1952. Well, the Air Resources Board is just one event that happened. But the reason why this is good news is because Los Angeles had a problem, huge problem, figured out they were causing it. And although they haven't solved it completely, it is a completely different situation there now. Like, I've been to LA.
Dude, LA's pretty famous for its smog. In fact, yeah. I've been there and seen it. And
I've been there six or seven times. And the worst I've seen the smog is when I've been in the valley. But it's nowhere near what it used to be. Three quarters of the time. So, like.
That's amazing because the city has grown.
Yeah, absolutely.
Enormously.
And the economy has grown.
All the cars on the road.
And, yeah. And so they did a bunch of stuff. The main thing was, and we actually mentioned this last episode, the advent of the catalytic converter was a huge turning point that was created in its current form. Earlier versions were around, but it was created in its current form in 1973, and then it became mandated in California in 1975. So all the new cars had to have them. And then California has been progressively wheeling out like more and more legislation to try and tackle this problem over time. So it's not just cars, but they've introduced some of the most robust emission standards in America for their heavy industry as well, for their production. When the smog first started happening, they just assumed it was sulfur, because everywhere else it was caused by sulfur, which is
out of the industry pipes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a big problem with coal-fired power plants, but they didn't have a lot in California or in LA specifically, so they were like, that's weird that it's happening here. But it does have, it's a natural basin, so things just sit there.
Yeah, like Christchurch.
Like Christchurch, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, if you flash forward to more recent times, they introduced a rebate where you can get up to $7,000 to get EV cars, and they were like the first state in the nation to really push for EV cars. And now I can say this firsthand as someone who's been to LA a bunch of times, I should have looked this number up, but I didn't. But it seems to me, just looking around, it's like at least one in four cars you see on the highway are electric vehicles.
Nice.
Because there's all these government incentives to make them cheaper to run, and the infrastructure really supports it there. So you can plug in and drive away. And I mean, just the amount of cars in LA is insane. So it's so heartening to me that they... It's like you were saying, there was such, you would expect such inertia because it's such a big system. Like, LA is basically just a network of highways.
Yeah.
And they must have had to fought so hard to get these changes done. But they did, because they had to. And they did it through just like progressive laws and the local governments coming in and raising the emission standards again.
So your good news is a bit of a combo of... Government's actually just...
It's people actually
doing a bit of,
fixing it.
Yep, doing a bit of good legislation.
Yeah.
And then actually it was a technology advance as well.
Which I always love.
I know, and I'm not such a... Well, I think it's got its... I mean, obviously it's got its place. Some massive wins can happen in that space, but we just have to get our values...
Yeah, we've got a couple.
We've got to get
two.
Those foundational sort of things sorted.
For sure.
Yeah, rather than just relying on those quick fixes. But no, obviously that's fantastic.
Yeah, although I'm just adding this because it's funny, but it does undercut my point.
True comedian.
LA still has the most unhealthy air in America.
Huh.
It's won that award 19 of the last 20 years. But I think a lot of it is based on its basic like geographic features. Because it's got these weird things called temperature inversion traps or something.
Yeah, we've got one of those.
Where's we?
Oh,
like Auckland?
My farm.
Right.
Farmlet.
So it stops the air circulating
as
it normally would.
We're in a valley and, I was speaking to the original owner and I said to her, oh, there's a really nice place up by the water tank where I've noticed in winter I just walk up there and it's just always dry and feels warm and it's such a nice little place. And she said, oh, yes, that's the, what did you just say?
Inversion.
Blah, blah, blah. And, and so she explained it all to me. It's a thing where, something to do with... Yeah, hot air rising, getting trapped, and then it can't get up.
What you're saying is right. Yeah, so
but basically
it just sits there.
Yeah,
hot air
gets to sit. Yeah.
And it kind of creates a very still environment, which is, I think as well what happens in Christchurch because it's so flat and there's not a lot of wind to blow it away. So it just, all those chimneys in winter when it gets real cold just sits there. But Christchurch is probably a success story of sorts as well, because they outlawed the chimneys. I had asthma as a kid, and my mum reckons...
And you're a Christchurch boy, eh?
Yeah, well, my mum totally attributes that to just the amount of smog that was in Christchurch when I was growing up.
Well, I moved to Christchurch in 97, and at the time, there was a lot of smog in winter. Really, like, would notice it. Really,
yeah,
like I said,
absolutely.
It was just this... It must have been about 2 metres off the ground, because, you could sort of almost put your hand in it.
Totally, and just sit there.
Yep, and now... that's just totally dealt with.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, so there you go, progress, everyone. So fantastic news. I with the story we led with, we should have finished with, because it was by far the best one, I reckon.
I know. You know, I was thinking about that. Like, a good journalist would have saved the best till last. But I got so excited.
So just to recap on that scheme, do you know when it's going to kick off?
No.
Okay. It's been announced, though. That's what we know. It is happening. It's happening in New Zealand.
The big announcement was that the government has commissioned the design of the scheme.
Oh, so that means they're not even necessarily committed to...
Oh, yeah, no, they are.
This is still a big one.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, do you reckon...
They are.
Yeah. Okay. Take it from waving everyone. It's happening.
No, it's true. I read the press release from the ministry, and it's all go.
Awesome.
So we just don't need to... worry about that.
Excellent. Taken care of. The fight has been fought. If you've got any good news stories as well, flick them through to us. They could be from history. They could be from your local area where you live, like a cool little local story where you've done something awesome. We're on facebook.com/howtosavetheworld, just all in a row like that. And otherwise, we will catch you on the next episode. Thank you very much for listening to the pod. Give us a review if you can. Chuck us 5 stars. It's very helpful to get other people to see us. And until then, keep changing the world, everyone.
Yay!
Thanks again to our wonderful sponsor, Atik. Atik are a zero-waste beauty company dedicated to ridding the world of plastic waste.
Woo! Get yourself or someone you love some Atik products from atikworld.com.